I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. I welcome Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University, Princeton University, Russian History Emeritus. It is a new year, but it is the same new Cold War that was with us for the last 4 years. This crisis began several years ago in Ukraine, and we turn to Ukraine tonight because of breaking news that is significant, not as a solution, but as an exacerbation of the new Cold War. The Trump administration, following the reporting in the Washington Post, has approved the largest U.S. commercial sale of lethal defensive weapons to Ukraine since 2014. Administration officials confirmed that the State Department this month approved a commercial license authorizing the export of model M107A1 sniper systems, ammunition, and associated parts and accessories to Ukraine, a sale valued at $41.5 million. These weapons address a specific vulnerability of Ukrainian forces fighting a Russian-backed separatist movement in two eastern provinces. There has been no approval to export the heavier weapons the Ukrainian government is asking for, such as Javelin anti-tank missiles. A very good evening to you, Steve, and I recover that 4 years ago this event would not have been imaginable, but here we are so quickly. It is coming 4 years since the Maidan turmoil that resulted in the flight of Yanukovych, the elected president, and the turning from Ukraine to a country that is badly fragmented with an ongoing conflict with the Donbass and Crimea and with militias that are sponsored by unknown hands resembling much of the deep right pro-Nazi movements of the last 75 years. I remember quickly that on 18 February 2014, there was the initial sign of conflict after many months of debate in Ukraine about economic future. However, this conflict immediately started in Kiev when there was an attempt by protesters to march on the Constitutional Court of Ukraine to change the Constitution to the 2004 form. This is very inside baseball, but it has to do with a direct challenge to the government. The police pushed back. They used rubber bullets at that point and later live ammunition. On 19 of February, the next day, there were checkpoints in Kiev. A state of emergency was announced. On 20 February, the next day, the internal affairs minister, this is Yanukovych still in power, said that he'd signed a decree authorizing the use of live ammunition. On 21 February, Yanukovych signed a compromise deal with opposition leaders. And on 22 February, protesters in control of Kiev, Yanukovych was said to have fled the capital. In between, there were casualties, lots of casualties. Right now, the count is still 82 people dead in those few days, 13 police, including 13 policemen, more than 1,100 people were injured. Here we are, Steve, 4 years later, and the U.S. is selling sniper systems into the hands of this very damaged country. Good evening, Professor.
It's hard, John, to remember, but remember we must. The world before the Ukrainian crisis 4 years ago, I think it was 4 years ago that you and I started talking so regularly on your show. As I recall, we began talking about the dispute over the European Union's economic agreement offer to Ukraine, Putin's counteroffer on behalf of Russia, the president of Ukraine's decision. By the way, he didn't refuse to sign the European agreement. He just asked for more time. That led to the protest, and the protest led to all the rest, the violence, the president fleeing, the annexation of Crimea, the still ongoing civil war in eastern Ukraine. The world before that, I would argue with you just a little bit, the way you introduced it. You and I had been talking about a new Cold War before Ukraine. I had been warning of a new Cold War for at least 10 years, blaming it primarily on Washington's policy toward Moscow. But there is no doubt in my mind that 4 years ago, the Ukrainian crisis transformed and continues to transform the new Cold War in ways that are fundamentally different than the old Cold War. Suffice it to say, I've mentioned it several times, that the new Cold War contains several fronts Russian-American fronts, American-Russian fronts, that are fraught with the possibility of hot war. But the one that remains the epicenter is Ukraine. And that was true. You and I recognized that as it unfolded 4 years ago. It remains true, maybe truer today, as emphasized by the selling of these weapons. What happened 4 years ago, I think this is the way the historians will record it when they get focused and get their research documents in order, is that 4 years ago, we witnessed the militarization of the new Cold War. Prior to that, it had been mainly increasingly anti-Putin, Russophobic policies in Washington for about, I guess, a decade. But except for the war in Georgia, you remember that in 2008 in August, when Saakashvili, the president of Georgia, attacked a Russian protectorate inside Russia, south Ossetia. And then the Russians came into Georgia, quickly won that war, and retreated. There hadn't really been any direct military confrontation, even by proxy. Ukraine changed all that and froze it in place, because we have right on Russia's border, I mean, right in the heart of Russian civilization, Slavic, Ukrainian, Russian civilization, a civil war. One side backed by Russia, one side backed by the United States. We never had that during the 45-year Cold War. All those civil wars when the United States backed one side, the Soviet Union another side, and I say this for the benefit of your younger listeners, those took place in what were called the Third World, far away, in Africa, in the Middle East, but not in Europe, not on Russia's borders. So I think Ukraine, the crisis that began 4 years ago and continues to unfold today, has changed so much. It's left us with a new institutionalized, highly militarized, more dangerous Cold War on Russia's borders. It's changed American politics, where Ukraine, partly because of the large Ukrainian diaspora in the United States and in Canada, Ukraine is now a hot-button issue. There'll be no improving relations with Russia until something is resolved in Ukraine. Secretary of State Tillerson said the other day, rightly, that we are never going to get back to a cooperative relationship with Russia until we come to some kind of agreement about Ukraine. I think that's absolutely right. It's also changed, John, and we can talk about this some other time. I think politics inside Russia for the foreseeable future. People say Putin, Putin, Putin. But I think that no established Kremlin leader could have behaved any differently than did Putin in 2014. I refer here to the annexation of Crimea, or what Russians call bringing Crimea home, because they saw Crimea and the Russian naval base at Sevastopol there in danger from NATO. And also, once civil war broke out in Donbass in eastern Ukraine against the Kiev government, no Russian leader would have had any choice more than did Putin. He had to support them to some degree. He couldn't let Kiev take Donbass by force. And that's where we are today. So the world before Ukraine and after Ukraine is going to be one of those landmarks that historians 20, 30, 40, maybe 50 years from now are going to devote a separate chapter to when they write the history of the 21st century. That's how important I think Ukraine was then and remains today.
I recover, Steve, your remarks from 2008 during the Georgia crisis. You at the time, summarizing where we were, there was lots of melodrama. Mr. Putin came back from the Beijing Olympics. Joe Biden, the senator, was at that time one of the possible choices to the vice presidency, was on hand to go to Kiev to back up the new regime after Yanukovych fled. Putin went back to, Putin went back to Moscow to supervise particularly the Georgia crisis from, because Medvedev at the time was president, and the whole drama turn very quickly into a test between the United States and Russia. You said at the time, they'll survive this. They'll knit this back together. But Ukraine is the red line. If they cross that, there'll be a crisis. You said that in 2008, Steve. And so what you were saying at the time, I mean, you have a good crystal ball. What you were saying at the time was commonplace, I'm presuming, in the Kremlin leadership. They knew that Georgia, they'll tolerate being torn apart and balkanized, but they will not tolerate the same game in Ukraine, and they didn't.
So what you're raising here, and fundamentally correctly, I think, is how did this happen? I mean, the Ukrainian crisis. What was the prehistory? Mm-hmm. And you point out that, what is it, 6 years before, when the Georgian War broke out, I said that Russia has two red lines. One is Georgia, but far more fundamental is Ukraine.
And I'm going to leave it there because you get to explain when we come back.
Right.
You were 6 years ahead, but you all saw the same thing. Steve Cohen, professor, New York University, Prince University. We're talking about the origins of the Ukraine crisis, but now we have to go back to 2008 when Barack Obama was running very, very well to become president of the United States. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show.
A good night's sleep is the best idea for your health. And Helix Sleep is the mattress that's designed just for your best ever night's sleep. There are a lot of online mattress retailers these days, all with a one-size-fits-all sleep solution. You know what? One-size-fits-all is wrong. Helix Sleep offers something completely different. A mattress that's made to your special preferences and won't set you back thousands of dollars. Go to helixsleep.com/John and take the simple 2 to 3 minute sleep quiz. Helix Sleep can build you a custom mattress that will suit you like a dream. For couples, they also personalize each side of the mattress. Everyone's talking about Helix Sleep, and once you try it, you'll know why. Your custom mattress arrives direct to your door in a week. Shipping is completely free. Try it for 100 nights. If you don't love it, it will be picked up and you will be refunded in full. Go to helixsleep.com/John, J-O-H-N, right now, and you'll get $50 towards your custom mattress. That's helixsleep.com/John for $50 off your order. helixsleep.com/John.
Balance of Nature's fruits and veggies.
I'm John Batchelor with Professor Steve Cohen, and we're recovering 4 years into the Ukraine crisis, the origins of the Ukraine crisis, not the February violence, but back to August of 2008 during the Georgia crisis, when the professor, analyzing the drama that was very quick and very hard to understand, tanks and airplanes and pieces of Georgia being fragmented, Abkhazia and South Ossetia, very difficult names to pronounce, and at the same time the heroic members of the Georgian resistance up against the long column of Russian military vehicles. But at the time, the professor said, this is something they'll survive, but they won't survive if this comes to Ukraine. 6 years later, it came to Ukraine. Steve, when you saw Georgia, when the Kremlin saw Georgia, did they conclude that NATO was behind this, that NATO was going to keep going and pushing this until they had both Georgia and Ukraine?
By they, you mean the Kremlin?
Yes, the Kremlin.
Absolutely. And you said before that, I know you didn't mean it, but metaphorically I had a crystal ball, but I didn't have any crystal ball. I just had two capacities. One was to read and one was to listen. And that's something that Washington doesn't do when it comes to Russia, because there had been a print and broadcast dialogue about NATO expansion going on for more than a decade. It was clear from authoritative voices in Washington, speaking mainly but not only in the Washington Post, that the ultimate prize, I think I can quote several authoritative Washington spokespeople, that the ultimate prize after the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 was to move Western power, NATO, American power, eastward. And the prize, I quote here, the prize was Ukraine. And one can see why. It was always this view that without Ukraine, Russia could never be a powerful great power again. the view that Ukraine was a divided country, therefore susceptible, divided between East and West. So it was broadcast in Washington in the most authoritative ways by senators such as McCain and others that the goal was to bring Ukraine into NATO one way or another. Remember in 2008, President George Bush made an announcement that both Georgia and Ukraine would be offered membership soon, and it was vetoed by Germany and France. So the impulse, the intention in Washington was clear. Now, one thing that the Kremlin does, and by Kremlin I mean metaphorically, the people who, the policy elite of Russia that advised the Kremlin by following American politics and policymaking in the media, they heard this just as clearly as I did. And they said repeatedly, and this is why I did not need a crystal ball, Ukraine is a red line. They said it over and over and over and over again. That, okay, you've taken in the whole of Eastern and Central Europe, you're headed for our borders, you've made a go at our soft underbelly in the Caucasus, Georgia, that didn't end well for you, we push back, but if you push on for Ukraine, all bets are off. And we pushed on. There are two narratives, John, if we have a couple of minutes left
segment. Yes, go ahead.
There are two narratives, and I think listeners, if they read up a little bit, can decide both narratives are semi-false. But I think the American narrative of how this crisis came about is more false than the Russian narrative. The Western narrative, the American narrative is that Ukraine was a freedom-loving country, enslaved by Russia for centuries, and yearning to be free. And all that happened was is the European Union offered the Ukrainian president, Viktor Yanukovych, a benign, benevolent, civilizational, economic partnership, whereby Ukraine would drift economically in its trade toward Europe, even though I think about 40% of its trade at that time was with Russia, and therefore escape Russian tyranny and become a prosperous Western democracy. That remains the myth of Maidan, that Maidan was a democratic revolution, that everything that's unfolded in Ukraine since is a valiant democratic government in Kiev warding off one Russian attack after another. The problem with that narrative is it's not true, or at least it's fundamentally untrue. I've already mentioned that NATO expansion from the beginning had as the great prize Ukraine. This was moving Western power, not for civilizational or economic reasons, but geopolitical reasons, to Russia's border. And the border that mattered the most was Ukraine. This was clear to everybody. The other reality is, if for historical reasons, blame God, blame, you know, history, centuries of history, in terms of its inclinations, Ukraine was then and remains today a very divided country by economics, marriage, politics, religion, culture. Western Ukraine is much closer to Hungary, Poland, to Eastern Europe. Eastern Ukraine is virtually Slavic and Russian-speaking. The country was divided. And then in the center of Ukraine are people who kind of would like to live with both. To intervene and try to tug Ukraine away from Russia was bound to lead to something akin to civil war, if not the collapse.
Just a minute,
of
Professor.
Ukrainian state.
You've got a second reason to come up. Hold on. It's John Batchelor with Professor Stephen F. Cohen. We're reviewing Ukraine 4 years into the conflict, but this is the story of the U.S. and Russia deteriorating over many years, and certainly you'd have to say today, it's a crisis. I'm John Batchelor.